The Tom Woods Show, episode 1233.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here. The Tom Woods Show.
Hi, everybody. Tom Woods here. This is so great and exciting for Bob Murphy. A lot of you know Bob Murphy. If you don't know Bob Murphy, that means you are not listening to my other podcast that I do once a week, Contra Krugman. We take a Paul Krugman New York Times column and we go through it with a fine-tooth comb. And we teach some economics by refuting Krugman, and it's lots of fun. Well, Bob has put together not a collection of transcripts from the show, who would want that, but instead a collection of all his smashes of Krugman across a wide variety of subject areas over the years. And it's a wonderful way for you to learn economics because you read what the mainstream is saying and you watch Bob dismantle it. And it's beautiful. Sometimes it's like a surgeon's precision and sometimes it's with a sledgehammer. And in all cases, it's fun and educational. And the book is called Contra Krugman, Smashing the Errors of America's Most Famous Keynesian. You can check it out at ContraKrugmanBook.com. Bob, as you know, holds a PhD in economics from New York University. He is the author of many other books. He is formerly a professor at Hillsdale College. He publishes the Laura Murphy Report, which is a financial publication, and he's just doing a whole lot of things, all of which are outstanding and great. Bob, welcome back.
Glad to be here, Tom. Always a pleasure to be on your show.
How about this? There is actually a book. I'm holding it in my hand, and it weighs a ton. Contra Krugman, Smashing the Errors of America's Most Famous Keynesian. Let's make clear, this isn't like a book of transcripts of our show. I mean, who would want that? You'd want to set fire to that. This is kind of like your collected works over the years, going after Krugman and teaching economics in the process. That's really what you're doing in here. People are going to learn when they see the table of contents and all the different topics covered. It's amazing what they're going to learn. And there's going to be some theory, but mainly the economics they're going to learn here is the kind of economics they can use when they're arguing with their friends or when they feel cornered and they don't know what to say, or it just seems like, well, all respectable people think blah, 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 but yet the statistics show the opposite of blah, blah, blah. So how respectable could those people be? You'll have all this at your fingertips thanks to this book. So Bob, why don't you tell us the origins of this book? Like, for example, even though it took a long time to produce, who really was pushing you to do it?
Well, it was this short little man that I know. And
oh, that's terrible. Michael Malice, you mean?
No, it was you, Tom. Folks, basically, okay. You know how they say, behind every successful libertarian, there's Tom Woods. That's how that adage goes. You were pushing me, Tom. It was your idea. And so the context here, folks, as Tom is saying, is, you know, I write articles that get published in various outlets over the years. And, you know, anytime Krugman would write on something, and he writes on a variety of things, so you might just know him as, oh, yeah, he's the big guy for Keynesian spending, right? Well, yes, he is, but he also writes a lot on climate change and healthcare and all these other things. And so if I had an outlet, like, for example, I'm the senior economist for the Institute for Energy Research, so anytime Krugman would write something about the economics of climate change and the carbon tax in particular, you know, I would write something critiquing him, because that's always a good foil. People like to, you know, see a debate, as it were, instead of someone just from first principles on a blog post. And also I write for what's called Econ Lib. They have monthly articles that are longer pieces that are supposed to be more, you know, pedagogical, just teaching things to people learning economics and things like that. And so when Krugman would write about how, oh, yeah, all the research shows that there's no evidence that lowering taxes increases economic growth, you know, things like that, where he's making it sound like this is some right-wing myth, well, then I would take the opportunity to go through and summarize the research and say, well, no, actually, here are these seven literature reviews and go through and show how, oh, and all these peer-reviewed journals and even from people like Christina Romer, showing that, no, actually, it turns out that when you control for all these effects, that imagine that, the government taking fewer resources actually leads to faster economic growth. So these things were all over the place, and Tom said, you know, Bob, we should really put those into one volume, and you should do that. It wouldn't take that much work. And you are right, Tom. It's now that it's done and it's sitting there, and it's – folks know that I'm very modest, but I tell you, I was flipping through this thing when it was done, and I actually felt bad for Krugman. And how do you feel about that, Tom? I mean, someone reading this thing is going to be like, man, this guy really, He takes a lot of criticism in this thing.
Yeah, he does, as a matter of fact. It's unbelievable. I mean, it's just an ancillary benefit that it really smacks Krugman around. The primary benefit is that every conventional argument that's been made about the way people like you and I look at the economy is dismantled, smashed, refuted, and replied to in here. And that's the primary thing. And then you get the special pleasure of seeing the nasty Krugman taken to task. Because even some of his own colleagues kind of feel like he's a nasty person, the way he treats people, the way he misrepresents other people's views, and then triumphantly bats them down when they actually didn't say that in the first place. It gets irritating after a while, even if you are a Keynesian. Gets irritating. So you've got in here a foreword by Ron Paul, which is very good. He says something like, if there's anybody who at the time of the financial crisis was more prolific in defending the free market than Bob Murphy, I'd like to know who it is. Well, that's pretty good, right? I mean, so even Ron Paul himself, maybe Ron Paul would be the one person we might allow, but he would never say that about himself. But he's got a very nice thing. I wrote the preface to it. I recorded the audiobook version, folks. And, you know, when you record the audiobook version of a 600-page book, it takes a while. That takes a little bit of time, but well worth it. And the Kindle version is like six smackers. It's ridiculous. Like, you should go over and get it. So first of all, the website, ContraKrugmanBook.com. ContraKrugmanBook.com is where you should go check it out. All right, just looking through the table of contents here, all these are interesting because we've got stimulus and minimum wage and financial reform and business cycles and wages and monetary policy and the Great Depression and trade, Obamacare, austerity, tax cuts, debt, climate change, predictions. Wow. Hard to know where to start, but I'm going to pick a place. Okay. It's not a place that we talked about beforehand, but I do want to talk a little bit about austerity if we could, because still to this day, people say we tried austerity. And by we, they mean the Europeans and to some extent the Americans. We tried austerity and it didn't work. And that just goes to show that you ideologues refuse to respond to evidence. You cannot be reached through evidence. You're unreachable. You're devoted to your outdated 19th century philosophy. What's the answer to that?
Okay, so good question. And again, folks, as Tom is saying, this is not me just being an armchair libertarian and, you know, reasoning out from first principles and saying, so clearly, you know, the free market ruled. I mean, we obviously have a set of principles, but as Tom says, I mean, a lot of this is very empirical, because I understand if someone's saying, no, the data contradicts what your armchair theory is, you got to really kind of, you know, go and show that why they made a mistake in the data they grabbed. So with this one, yeah, there's a few levels of response. I'll try to keep it brief here. So one thing, Tom, is that it's important when you talk about austerity, that yes, there are countries that implemented, quote, austerity, and then they really did suffer, and I certainly wouldn't have endorsed what they did. But what that would mean in practice in a lot of these places, especially in Europe, was, oh, the government would come in, would bail out the banks with taxpayer money, and then would impose a big tax hike and possibly cut some other forms of government spending to contain the increase in the spending that was necessary to bail out the banks for the bad loans that they made. All right. So, yeah, that's certainly not, you know, bailing out banks for their bad decisions and then imposing tax hikes on people while the economy is already on the ropes. That's certainly not something that a libertarian would support ethically. And it's not in line with, you know, Austrian theory in terms of what could policymakers do to ease an economy that, is on the ropes. Now, on the other hand, if what you mean by austerity is simply that the government's going to cut spending and that's the way that we're going to impose pain and tighten our belts and whatever, that's actually pretty good. You know, in terms of standard libertarian, you know, ethically, that's right. You're stealing less from the public in that scenario. But even just the standard economic analysis, there have been studies, and not from like the Heritage Foundation, but from, I think one of them came out from the ECB. It was some, you know, international type group like that, and it was not an ideological pro-market entity by any stretch. But they had one of their research, you know, monthly bulletins or something come out, and they looked at countries that primarily tried to close their budget gap through cutting spending rather than from hiking taxes. And they found that didn't cause them to sink further into recession. All right. And so that's an example. There's also like Canada famously in the mid to late 90s really turned around its budget situation. They were on the verge of having a debt crisis spiral out of control. They did raise taxes a little bit, but they mostly cut spending for a few years to get it under control. and they went from a string of budget deficits to a string of budget surpluses. And that didn't, you know, their economy didn't fall off a cliff. So there's all these examples of countries cutting spending as a way to deal with budget deficits that don't lead to disaster. And the Keynesians never point to that. And in fact, Krugman, and I document, goes through and tries to explain away all these cases. Oh, well, you know, their currency depreciates, so they exported more. Or, oh, well, you know, the central bank cut interest rates and da da da. So that's how. And, you know, he has to explain away all these cases. On the flip side, we have plenty of evidence of cases where the government engaged in massive deficit spending. You know, in other words, the quote right thing to do, where it was a basket case, right? And so, you know, FDR and Hoover himself too, but FDR in particular, they say, oh yeah, he engaged in deficit spending. It's not like the 1930s were a great economy. And, you know, Obama certainly engaged in stimulus, anti-austerity measures, and it's not like the U.S. economy was great. So with all these things, Tom, what they do is they set up an alternate universe that we can't observe and say, oh, it's a good thing that Obama did engage in his stimulus package. Otherwise, we would have had the second Great Depression, right? And so, no, in practice, what you see is there's plenty of cases where governments that have a big deficit, even if they're on the verge of going into a recession, if they just cut spending primarily, they're fine. And then we forget about them. We don't use them as an example of anything because they didn't collapse. Whereas countries that do engage in the Keynesian prescriptions end up having awful economies. And then the Keynesians come in and say, oh, that's because they didn't do enough of the medicine. That's why.
I want to switch around just because there's so much to talk about here. I could do follow-up questions all day, but we're probably going to do one episode on this book. So I want to just give people a flavor of all the different stuff that's in there, but also talk about not just the economics, but also just show how slippery Krugman is and how slippery you have to be in order to make these ideas stick. So let's cast our minds back a bit to the days of the sequester. I've got some young listeners who were probably, I don't know, in diapers during the sequester. Not quite, but they were, you know, they were pups in the days of the sequester. Remind us what the sequester was and what Krugman had to say about it and what wound up happening.
Okay, sure. So this was something, so again, set the stage, folks. Remember, Obama comes in, he wins in the 2008 election. He's inaugurated in 2009. And then there's the whole Tea Party revolt and a lot of new Republicans come into office. And so the Republicans, of course, remember, Republicans are great folks when there's a Democrat in the White House. Then all of a sudden, the, you know, Republicans remember that they're for less spending and so forth. And so one of the things they did, they kept having these budget fights. You know, there are various rounds of it, but I think it was like in the winter of 2012, they were fighting over stuff and they could not come to an agreement. And so they had this sort of poison pill in the legislation saying, okay, if we can't come to this agreement, there's going to be sequestration that's going to kick in early 2013, which was going to be some actual budget cuts. And here, Tom, I know you and I are cynical on this stuff and other longtime watchers of Washington, D.C., and that, oh, yeah, a cut in Washington means a slowdown in the rate of growth. But actually, there were, I mean, literally the absolute amount of federal spending went slightly down a little bit, at least, you know, in this one-shot thing, and some slight tax hikes, okay? And so that was what sequestration was. And again, it was going to kick in January of 2013 if such and such compromise couldn't be achieved in it, and it wasn't. So, you know, you roll into there. And so Krugman, of course, is going crazy saying, are you kidding me? The recovery from the Great Recession is very lackluster. I mean, thank goodness we had Obama in there and Bernanke, and they weren't listening to these nut jobs like Ron Paul. But still, the economy is very tender right now. The last thing we need is to engage in austerity at this point, which is, you know, sequester would be a function of that. Now, remember, folks, that this is also when the rounds of QE are going, a quantitative easing. So you had the Federal Reserve doing what it could to stimulate, you know, in terms of the Keynesian worldview. And then you had, though, on the fiscal side, you had these crazy Republicans who were sort of playing chicken with the fate of the country in order to score political points against Obama. This is the narrative Krugman's painting, such that in April of 2013, Krugman actually wrote and said, well, you know, there's two camps here. You know, some of us are saying that this fiscal sequestration is a doomsday device that we're imposing on ourselves. That's his literal phrase. You know, he's grabbing it from the Dr. Strangelove movie. You know, in other words, we're going to intentionally blow up our own economy. That's how he described it, saying this was like a, you know, an unforced error where we're just going to hurt ourselves for no reason. And then he said, on the other hand, you know, the Fed's doing what it can, but we're in a liquidity trap. And so its hands are tied. And so he's saying, so this is kind of a good test to see, you know, are we conventional Keynesians right? or these guys like the market monetarists who think the Fed can just offset everything and that really as long as the Fed's doing the right job, then we can, you know, cut spending. Are they right? And he said right now, and he's writing it as of April 2013, he's saying we're getting a good test of this and it doesn't look good for my opponents. Okay, because at that point, the economy didn't seem to be doing very well. Okay, well, it turned out the rest of 2013 played out and it performed better than, you know, what the consensus forecast had said it would, such that by January 2014, you had guys like Scott Sumner, who's a market monetarist, you know, the guy saying that, you know, this whole thing was caused by the Fed. He was kind of running victory laps going, well, you know, this is the gauntlet they threw down and we did well. So I guess we're right, huh? And Krugman actually, in a column in January 2014, Tom, is, you know, alluding to these market monitors who are saying that somehow this last year was a test. And he's complaining about just how dishonest they are and saying, clearly, if you're going to do something like assess economic policy, you don't just look at one country for 1 year. You got to look at a whole range, a bigger sample. And then he put a scatter plot of Europe, you know, in all the different European countries and with on one axis, like the unemployment rate and the other axis, you know, did they engage in austerity or not? And then, you know, he draws a line through and says, see, I'm right when you look at all of Europe. So that's just one example, Tom, of, you know, number one, how his prediction blew up in his face. But beyond that, just how slippery he was. He literally laid out this test. And when he thought he was winning, said, yep, this is a good test of who's right or wrong. Then when that blew up in his face and somebody else mentioned, yeah, you know, that test Krugman picked, we won. Krugman's complaining about how dishonest they are for thinking that's a test. And I'm not exaggerating in any way, folks.
This no, it's right in there.
All documented. You have to get the book to see, to get the proof. But I am not exaggerating. That is literally what happened.
Bob, just a quick sponsored message before we go on. I remember years ago talking to Mark Thornton, who had studied job training programs. And in his state, he found that the number of people in a year who went through a state job training program and came out the other side with a job in the field for which they had been trained was like one or two people. It was a shocking number. That just hasn't worked all that well. And as I keep saying, one of the great things about the internet is that you can get your own job training. You can teach yourself skills through courses you can find online. And really the best central place for these courses is Skillshare, because there you get access to 23,000 classes in just one membership. And it's all kinds of things: design, business, technology, photography, entrepreneurship, film, writing. And what's particularly impressive about it is that my folks are getting a special deal: 2 months of access to the 23,000 classes for just 99 cents. Head over to Skillshare.com/woods to redeem that amazing offer. 2 months of Skillshare for just 99 cents. Check it out at Skillshare.com/woods. Let's say something also about climate change, because there you have plenty of knowledge as a because of your work with the Institute for Energy Research. And you've written some articles on this subject, including in the academic sphere. And Krugman here, I mean, neither of you is a climate scientist, as you will constantly be reminded of this. Krugman will not be constantly reminded he's not a climate scientist, but we can leave that stuff aside and just look at what the likely economic consequence. Well, you know what? Why am I answering the question for you? Tell us about Krugman and climate change and what's wrong.
Yeah, not only are you not a climate scientist, I mean, you're not even an economist of climate change. So you really...
No,
yeah.
Yes. I have no business even asking the question.
You're right. So, and this is something, folks, that, you know, and Tom's right. I do try to be clear with people because I want them to understand. Let me just very briefly here say something that to try to frame this. It is, you'll hear these things all, and Krugman does this too, so it's certainly relevant to this issue for today's podcast episode, but they will act as if, oh, there's this huge consensus. And Krugman even recently just said something like, oh yeah, I suppose there's this huge conspiracy and all the scientists in the world are lying about climate change and not one single one of them is deviating from the orthodoxy. Okay, sure guys, that makes sense. And you'll see figures like, oh, 97% of the publishing climate scientists agree. And that is extremely misleading, okay? That even the people, Tom said, I do some stuff. I have a study from Cato that's a critique of a U.S. carbon tax, for example, that I do with Pat Michaels and Chip Knappenberger. Those are both actual climate scientists. So they both would be part of that 97% consensus, even though they're co-authors with me on a study opposing a U.S. carbon tax. Okay. And so what that means when they say this consensus, that means somebody who thinks, yes, the globe is warmer now than it was like in 1750. And yes, other things equal, emissions of carbon dioxide and other greenhouse gases from human activities would contribute to some of that warming. That's what people, you know, if you want to get the 97% consensus, that's what that means. But notice there's no government policy prescriptions that necessarily flow from that. Somebody might even agree with those statements I just said and say that's a good thing. Like maybe the earth was going to cool and that this is going to offset that a little bit. Or maybe all things considered, the fact that the earth is going to be warmer now is a good thing because fewer elderly people die in the winter. And certain areas now can plant different types of crops. And so maybe, right? So there's all kinds of things like that, nuances where you get into this debate. So anyway, as far as Krugman, I'll just make one observation about a particular thing where I caught him bluffing, is Krugman, he'll talk about how we need to take urgent action. And when back going into the 2016 election, he literally, I'm not exaggerating, folks, he literally said the fate of the planet rest on this election. And if Donald Trump wins, then he's going to have the ego that destroyed the planet. Okay. Or maybe he said it. He used some Freudian thing. I don't know if it was ego or it, I forget. But that was the deal, right? So there was no nuance whatsoever. He wasn't thinking like an economist doing marginal cost benefit. It was just, if Donald Trump wins, literally the earth is over. Okay. And so what I pointed out was you can use the standard periodic reports from the UN's own agency, the IPCC, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. And they actually in one spot did an assessment to say if we delay these optimal mitigation measures until I think it was the year 2030, how much do the compliance costs increase? Right. And so they estimated this. What they were trying to do was to show what's the cost of delay of inaction. You know, in other words, and the people doing those numbers and publishing that, I'm sure the people at the UN, why they wanted that table in this document was it gave ammunition to people who wanted to say, hey, let's not drag our feet and wait around for more data. Let's go ahead and take action because it will be cheaper to deal with this sooner rather than later. And that's fine insofar as it goes. But my point was they weren't showing, oh, my gosh, if we don't do anything by 2030, just put an asterisk and you look down, it says we're all dead. That's not what it said. It just said, oh, it's going to be more expensive to, for example, achieve our targets for the year 2100s, you know, global temperature or atmospheric concentration levels, that to achieve those desired targets, it'll be more expensive if we wait till 2030 rather than if we start doing the policies now. Okay. And again, it was some tolerable number. It was more expensive, but it wasn't like it was a catastrophe. So I'm just saying little things like that where I'm just showing that no, Krugman's narrative does not work at all. And I'm not saying according to this Cato study, I'm saying according to the UN's own documents summarizing the peer-reviewed economics of climate change literature. So Krugman just, you know, what I noticed, Tom, and we document this in the book, is that he kind of just gave up. In other words, I think he realized at some point that he was going to do what he's going to do in terms of his New York Times column. I'm sure, you know, his academic work, to the extent that he still does that occasionally, you know, he's much more refined. And that's true. I've seen him give us talk, not in person, but I've seen, you know, excerpts of it. I've seen him give talks at academic conferences and he's, you know, mild-mannered, button-down shirt Paul Krugman, the economist. He's a different guy in his New York Times outlet where he just, as we say, Tom, on the show, on Contra Krugman, often you wouldn't even know he was an economist reading his column. He's just some demagogue, you know, lambasting greed and racism.
Now, speaking of greed and racism, let's talk about Austrian business cycle theory.
Well, the greed makes sense, right? Because
Right. Well, naturally. But no, what I actually want to talk about, I want to give you a chance to talk about, and again, I'm sorry to just jump from one thing to another, but I just want to give people a flavor of all the sort of stuff that's in here. The time that you had a bit of an exchange kind of in real time with Krugman and that he responded to you with respect to something you had written about Austrian business cycle theory, and then you wrote a reply to him. And he paid you a kind of a compliment, maybe kind of an odd compliment, but you've got that in here and Krugman's misunderstanding, because you'll never believe it. Krugman doesn't quite, it's not actually steeped in the literature of Austrian business cycle theory, but he still has plenty to say about it. So I think what we may need to do is have you give the most layman-y of layman overviews of Austrian business cycle theory. And this is the most important thing. If you're listening to this podcast right now and you're tempted to say, well, I think this is about to get complicated, I better move on to the next one. No. This is the piece of economic knowledge people need more than any other right now, which is the business cycle stuff. Why does the economy go up and down, up and down, up and down? Is that just a natural phenomenon and there's nothing you can do about it? Is it an artificial phenomenon? The Austrian school, which Bob belongs to, has something to say about that. And Krugman had something to say about what the Austrian school has to say about it. And it's very interesting how the whole episode unfolded. So I'm going to let you take it from here.
Okay, sure. And I agree with you, Tom. This is something, when I remember when I was younger and I was getting into the Austrian worldview, that was a big thing that really changed my mind. Because at first, just reading free market stuff, even people like Milton Friedman and others, you might get the sense that, oh yeah, there's, and some like non-economists perhaps, like just sort of conservative right-wing writers might say something like, well, yeah, there is the business cycle and there's booms and busts, but you know, that's the price we pay for innovation or so, you know what I mean? Like thinking that that really is something that's inherent to the market economy. And in the tradition of, you know, Mises and Hayek and their theory of the business cycle, no, it's actually government intervention, specifically interference with money and banking that causes it. So very quickly, the idea is that prices serve a function. They help coordinate economic activity, that, you know, entrepreneurs, they need to be able to use real market prices in order to guide their behavior. And one of the prices in particular is the interest rate, or actually there's multiple interest rates for different maturities and things, but interest rates, what they do, again, very loosely speaking, is they help coordinate long-term projects and activities, right? And so consumers, households, they decide in terms of their spending behavior, like, do we want to consume now or do we want to save some of our funds for the future? You know, if we got young kids and we want to start putting away money for them to go to college, or, you know, we're in our 40s and we want to have a big pile of assets at our disposal for when we retire so we can go on cruises, da, 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 right? So all those things where people are making real long-term trade-off decisions about, do I want to consume now or do I want to save? That has to get reflected somehow in what the economy is physically producing year after year. And so if the population is very present-oriented and they just want to have pizzas and go see movies and drive sports cars, okay, well then the economy is going to cater to those preferences as it should. You know, there's nothing wrong with being present-oriented in terms of economic science, but you'll see the economy will tend to just be pouring resources into building more movie theaters and pizza places and so forth. On the other hand, if people are more future-oriented, then the economy will cater to that, and you'll see resources getting plowed into making more drill presses and offshore oil platforms and research laboratories and physics textbooks, things like that, right? So that's fine, but the point being, the interest rate or the structure of interest rates needs to be correct to signal the right thing to entrepreneurs so they know, oh, should we be investing in long-term projects that won't really pay off until 20 years from now versus should we be tying up real resources in more short-term things that give their enjoyments within 6 months? And so the interest rate is the key thing that sort of regulates that, if you will. And so a high interest rate penalizes long-term investments, whereas very low interest rates put a low penalty on tying up funds for a long time. And so it sort of gives a green light to long-term projects. So with that framework now, you can see what Mises and Hayek elaborated upon was this idea that if the commercial banking system, particularly in the modern context with the central bank kind of goosing it, if it pushes interest rates down to artificially low levels by flooding the market with new money that really doesn't correspond to genuine saving, well, that sort of sets in motion investment in long-term projects, even though there's not the real physical savings to back it up. And so that causes a mismatch. The production structure gets out of whack. It's not internally consistent anymore. And it gives, perversely, an appearance of prosperity up front. Consumers feel richer, you know, businesses are hiring, everything seems great, but yet it's because there's this collective illusion that the economy is not as wealthy as people are being led to believe by this artificially low interest rate. And so you have a few years of a boom, but eventually it turns around into a bust because the government can't, by just creating electronic money, by buying assets and flooding the market with new funds, that doesn't actually make more capital goods available. That doesn't create more factories. And so physically it's impossible for the boom to continue. And the question's just when's the crash going to happen? All right. So I'll stop there, Tom. So that's standard Austrian business cycle theory in the context of a podcast, people driving and trying to get the point across fast.
All right. So is there a way to without getting super complicated, to talk about Krugman's views on this?
Yeah, sure. Yeah, I'll summarize real fast. And for people who want to go look at one thing, go ahead and look at Krugman's New York Times column called Great Leaps Backward, which was January 19th of 2011. So you'll see he actually cites me by name and links to a Mises.org post, right? So for those of you who think that, oh yeah, Bob's just in the corner taking swipes at this giant. No, he used to actually acknowledge me once in a while. And he says, even in this post, he says, someone, I don't know who at this point, sent me to this post by Robert Murphy, which is the best exposition I've seen yet of the Austrian view that's sweeping the GOP. Which is, you remember time when Lindsey Graham got up there and he was going through Roger Garrison's PowerPoints on C-SPAN? Remember that time? That was awesome.
Yeah, I know. It's I'm so overwhelmed with all the discussion of the topic everywhere.
So anyway, I'll very briefly, folks, I had written for Mises.org an article. I think it was called The Importance of Capital Theory. And I was responding to, I think Tyler Cowen and maybe somebody else had criticized Austrian business. Actually, I think it was Krugman as well. And they had some quibbles with, you know, how could it be that, if it's just a matter of resources getting sent to the wrong sector, why does the boom feel good? Like, how come unemployment doesn't rise in some sector? How come just the bust feels like a bad time? If in both cases, on the boom end and the bust end, resources are getting shifted around, why isn't it symmetric? Okay, so I walked through and tried to, you know, I used an analogy. I think it was pretty clever to try to spell that out. And so, you know, that's a lot of people have told me, incidentally, over the years that, yeah, your article, and they call it the sushi article because my little fictitious story involved people rolling and making sushi. So anyway, that was the thing where I walked through why you needed to have a theory of the capital structure. It wasn't just a matter of aggregate spending. You wouldn't be able to even see the Austrian story if you were just thinking in terms of aggregate spending. You needed to actually be thinking physically in terms of there's a capital structure in order to produce things. Prior decisions needed to be taken. And so, you know, there's a history involved. It's not just, oh, you know, how much money do I want to spend, or do I clam up and my animal spirits are preventing me from spending? That's not the issue. The issue is right now, what kind of productive machinery do we have at our disposal because of past investment decisions? All right, so that was that. And then Krugman, in this Great Leaps Backward, you know, so he's alluding to Mao's Great Leap Forward. He says that, yeah, actually, this story is internally consistent, what this guy Murphy came up with. And maybe that kind of describes what happened in Maoist China, where they tried to modernize too quickly. And so the population starved while Mao was trying to, you know, build his factory base up to the standards of the West. He was trying to industrialize too fast. So, yes, this is logically internally consistent. But come on, Krugman says, that's not what happens in modern Western economies, when clearly this is the fault of insufficient aggregate demand. Okay, so that's the kind of interchange that we had. And so what I did in response is just with several of his empirical offhand observations where he tried to show, look, if the problem were inadequate demand, like I'm saying, Paul Krugman, you'd see this in the data, and we do see it. And I just point out that, no, his particular examples don't really work. So one example is he looked in 2008, at the end of 2008, Krugman looked at the states, their unemployment rates, and how much their unemployment rate had increased over the past 12 months. He just grabbed the latest report from the Bureau of Labor Statistics. And he said, look, at the states with the biggest increase in unemployment don't really bear much relationship to the states that had the biggest decline in house prices. So these sort of, you know, real business cycle theory or Austrian types who are saying the recession is, you know, some sort of curative hangover because of the excesses of the housing bubble, they don't know what they're talking about. And so I pointed out in response, well, no, why are you picking the year-over-year change at the end of 2008? The housing bubble burst back in 2006. And so I reran his same test, except I changed the dates. I said, I ranked the U.S. states by saying which had the biggest drop in house prices since the bubble burst, and then in the same time period, which have seen the biggest increase in unemployment rates. And of those two lists, the worst six states, five of those states were on both lists, if you get what I'm saying. So the six states that had the biggest house price declines from when the bubble burst, five of them were also in the ranking of the states that had the biggest unemployment increases. So I was saying, by Krugman's own metric, actually the Austrian story makes a lot of sense. Whereas if it were just, oh, people panicked because of the financial crisis, so they stopped spending money, and so business just clammed up across the country, then you wouldn't see, you know, that would be an incredible coincidence, the data that I dug up. So things like that.
Now, that's pretty good stuff there. And as I said,
we should put that on the back of the cover. That's pretty good stuff, Tom Woods.
Well, look, I mean, the fact that you actually had an opportunity to take him on because he addressed you, which he shouldn't have done. He addressed you and you were able to respond and
well, he learned his lesson. He has not mentioned me.
Oh, yeah.
Well, he did once for the inflation stuff. And I do get in that, folks, too. That
right.
So,
right.
Yes.
Yeah, you're talking about that. But I think your sushi model helped a lot of people, which you read about in the book, to understand what the Austrians are saying about the economy in ways that I don't think they had quite fully gotten before. So it really is true that a lot of times when you're confronting error, the response to the error clarifies the original position in really helpful ways. You penetrate and understand it a lot better than you did before. At least your audience begins to understand a lot better. So you really put that into good use. And you got, I mean, this book, it's ridiculous. It's, first of all, it's beautiful, it's heavy, it's laid out very, very nicely, very attractive when you flip through it. You've got charts and graphs and scintillating prose. It does not read like an economics book. Okay. I don't mean that as an insult to your profession, Bob, but it reads like I wouldn't quite say it reads like Ayn Rand slicing and dicing her enemies, because that would, Bob, I don't think we could be friends if you were that, if that was your temperament. I'd be scared of you all the time. But you have your own way of going after your opponents, and this one in particular. So it's fantastic. So I strongly urge people to check it out at ContraKrugmanBook.com. Remember, I narrated the audiobook, and you can get the audiobook for free, and the author still gets his royalty. Don't worry about that. You get the audiobook through TomWoodsAudio.com. If you've never joined Audible before, they give you a free audiobook. You can listen to it, and then if you don't want to join Audible for good, you can just cancel, and you keep your free audiobook. So get that through TomWoodsAudio.com. And, of course, you should follow Bob, but right now, because of the principles of marketing, we want to minimize the number of links we're giving out. So Bob's blog will be linked on the show notes page, which I always have to give out, which is TomWoods.com/1233. There we'll link to what Bob is up to, Bob's books, this particular book, this brand new one that you need to get. It'll all be there, TomWoods.com/1233. Thanks, Bob.
Thanks for having me, Tom, and thanks for pushing me to do the book.
Yeah. My pleasure. All right, folks, before I let you go, I have a couple of time-sensitive things to tell you about. I hate doing this because then years later, this is just a waste of time on the episode, but I can't really help it. Number one, if meeting Ron Paul has been on your bucket list, then a great way to do that is at the Mises Institute Supporters Summit at the end of September, September 27th, 28th. It's going to be a great event. I'll be there as well, and it would be wonderful to meet some of you good folks there. So you can find out about that at tomwoods.com/events. The other thing is, I am doing, now this is really short notice, okay? I don't normally do this on the podcast, but this is really short notice. Monday, September 10th, 2018, I'm going to be in New York City, and some members of my supporting listeners group and I have gotten together to do an escape room. Now, if you don't know what an escape room is, Google it and you'll find out. But I've got 4 or 5 slots left. There are going to be 12 of us all together trying to conquer this particular room at 6:30 p.m. It's going to be, I'll just say, around the Theater District area, I'll just say for now, in Manhattan on Monday, September 10th. So I've got 4 or 5 slots left. If you're a member of the Supporting Listeners Program, and you'd like to participate. Now, this time you do, it is Dutch treat. Sometimes I've shelled out, but this time it's Dutch treats. $31 a person, but we're going to have a great, great time trying to conquer this room. If you would like to be part of that, then just drop me a note at tomwoods.com/contact. And if you'd like to go and I still have a slot open, then I'd love to add you. If you are not a member of the Supporting Listeners Program and you'd like to join it and then come and do the escape room with us, that'd be great. If I've got a slot left for you, I'd love to add you. So supportinglisteners.com is where you go to join that group. It's all good people, and they're all doing a good thing, which is helping me out with the show. But when I had a free couple of hours during an upcoming trip to New York, and I thought, I like doing escape rooms, and I'd like to get to meet some of the folks. And we have a, well, let's see, well, somebody that you might know, and it's not Michael Malice and it's not Dave Smith, but somebody, if you follow libertarian politics, you may know, will be joining us. So it's not Larry Sharp. I don't want to get you thinking that. But anyway, Somebody I've been meaning to get on the show will also be doing it with us. So it's going to be a great time. So if you'd like to do that and you're in New York, let me know. TomWoods.com/contact. Got to be member of the supporting listeners group. And that's it. See you tomorrow.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit TomWoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.